panel today, which is on gaming and gamification in the classroom. We've done a series, the Call Intersections done a series of what we call hot topics. These are subjects that are of particular interest in our field right now, and we have a set of five practitioners of gaming and gamification. So you'll see a range of aspects of the concept and its application. And I'll also mention that this panel is being webcast globally. So we welcome our global webcast audience too. We're going to start with an overview by Elizabeth Hansen Smith. Elizabeth is here with the State Department. So, Elizabeth.
Thanks a lot, Roger. I'm going to try and manipulate two of these things at the same time. I got interested in gaming because I worked with Deborah Healy on teaching a course last fall using trace effects and also gamifying the course for a group of teachers who were learning how to use trace effects, which is a language game that I'm going to talk a little bit about and Rick Rosenberg is going to talk about. I found that gamifying the course itself seemed to really work, and it's kind of surprised me because I was skeptical. So my talk today is going to be a little bit about some of my skepticism and a little bit about some of what I found in researching some of the positive aspects of using games. So if I can go on. Yes. Oh, it's working. What's gaming got to do with teaching and learning, or can we learn by playing is my topic. So I did a Google search, and the search was, why is gaming good for teaching, just for starters? And I found a lot of nonsense. It was very surprising. And from things like The Guardian, were the educational video games going to inspire the next generation? That's why developers are making games that mix the thrill of competing with strong social message. I don't think kids care much about social messages. And the second quote, creating a way for people to participate, find the subject engaging, and it gives them agency to learn about science. You know, and this stuff gets published. why shouldn't school make science engaging anyway? And isn't science engaging to begin with? You know, what are we doing to science that it's not engaging? So strange ideas about teaching and learning are going on here, too. Video games can teach kids how to learn things on their own quickly. Well, kids do that already. I mean, kids do learn quickly. I don't think games teach them to do that. Some suppositions here that are a little strange. Cognitive researcher says, video games can help us learn, focus, and fascinatingly, multitask. And I think multitasking has been soundly debunked in a number of good research articles. If educational games are well executed, they can provide a strong framework for inquiry and project-based learning. Why not just do project-based learning? Why use games? Games give us the skills necessary for navigating a complex, interconnected, rapidly changing 21st century. That's a pretty big claim, so I remain skeptical. But then I ran across, a very interesting TED Ed video by Jane McGonigal, The Game That Can Give You 10 Extra Years of Life. And she proves this mathematically in the course of this 10-minute video, which everybody who does gaming should watch this video. It's fascinating. I'm going to give you a very quick synopsis of what she says. She based her work on the top five wishes of the dying as expressed to hospice workers. Interesting way to go with this. One is, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. I wish I'd let myself be happier. Nobody says, I wish I'd worked harder and made more money. Interesting. I wish I'd had the courage to express my true self. I wish I'd lived up to my own dreams instead of what others expected of me. And McGonagall, in effect, is saying games can help us do all these things. For instance, on happiness, online games outperform pharmaceuticals in treating depression, and those are actual research studies. Surprising. On being who we really are, a Stanford University research study indicates playing games with an idealized avatar makes us more heroic, more ambitious, more committed to fulfilling our goals. Interesting again. And games are a way of staying in touch with friends, of managing social relationships, and I think that's a very interesting aspect of games also. I play a game called Tiny Zoo with my granddaughter, and this game has no redeeming social value whatsoever, right? It's not even accurate as to the habitats of the animals and the types of animals and stuff. Probably the only good thing about it is that you have to take care of the animals by feeding them once in a while. But I'm managing a social relationship here, and it's a good thing to be with my granddaughter. And we do it by phone and iPad. I tend to see gaming as educational games, or games that are adapted to education, and games that are actually designed to educate with something, and I guess that's a fairly common assumption, and maybe some of the other speakers have another way of talking about it. Minecraft, of course, is currently the hot game for adapting to education. We'll see some more examples of this, I think, from some of the other speakers. My son and granddaughter play it for hours together, so this is a split screen where my daughter is on the left and my granddaughter is on the left and my son is on the right with the kilt because he's Scots-Irish and he likes that. He can do all sorts of things. This is from a blog of an elementary school where third graders build habitats for animals in Minecraft, and then they do research on how to care for them and present what they've done with a whiteboard. And one of the teachers said, I was pleased to see many students going online to find more information about the animal and its habitat as they were building. Well, why didn't she assign them to do that is what I don't understand. You know, there's still some strange things being done in school. I'll go on quickly here. In a homeschooling blog, one parent was exploring portals. She set up portals so that each one of these habitats, each one of the portals leads to a different part of the curriculum. So this is a fairy tale village that leads to Alice in Wonderland reading, and the child built a little house for the white rabbit as part of the study. So they have interesting things. The zoo habitat that the child created at home. And then Minecraft is interesting because there's so much online help. I see my granddaughter doing enormous amounts of research online, looking up videos of how to do things, how to create things, where to find things, how to breed horses, all kinds of stuff. And you can get a free version of Minecraft to play at home, and there is an educational version of it also. So educational games, in comparison to games that are adapted like Minecraft, educational games are designed specifically to teach something. And there is a specifically educational version of Minecraft, Minecraft EDU. Includes mathematical concepts, perimeter, area, probabilities, and foreign languages, interestingly. And SimCity also is a learning and assessment tool for middle school students covering English, math, and other lessons related to the Common Core standards. So there are educational games out there. One of them we're going to talk about a little bit later. Rick Rosenberg is going to talk about using TraceFX. It is a game developed by the Department of State, and I was one of the script writers for this project, using a scenario of Trace in the future. He's thrown back into the past, which is present day, and then he has to do certain things like get a student identity card, meet people, make friends, get a part-time job, find somebody to give him a ride somewhere, join clubs. So kinds of things that international students might want to learn about the United States, and he travels all over the United States. There's listening and interacting. There is, I don't know how much detail Rick is going to go into, so I'm just going to flip through some of these very fast. There's a lot of teaching apparatus, teacher's manual that shows how to work through the game. There's a video that's accessible to teachers so they can just run through the game, see what the challenges are and how many points are scored and so on. There's a graphic comics for each chapter, language practice, games like drag and drop sentences, audio practice, Jeopardy, Boggle, various kinds of word games. So it's all already packaged as a way of teaching language. And Rick is going to talk more about that. So I'm going to go on to a virtual world. It's another kind of project like with game elements. And one school, this is a school in Australia that's using Top Dingo, which is the Second Life version in Australia, to teach various aspects of the curriculum. And this is an instructional page that they've set up to help students create avatars and so on in this Second Life type place. So some of the caveats about using games. Brain training games provide improve children's performance only on very similar games. So you're not really training the brain very much, you're just giving them practice. That's one problem with games. Children aren't really learning to think when they do brain games. Games alone will not make schools more efficient or replace teachers or serve as an educational resource that can reach an infinite number of students. Well, you know, the expense of setting up internet and buying the game and the interfaces and so on, that's going to make games hard to incorporate all over the curriculum. Positives. Nearly half of teachers surveyed say low-performing students benefit the most from using games in the classroom. And of course, ELLs would be considered part of this population of struggling and special education students. So maybe it's more important what the teacher believes about using games than what games actually do. I also tend to think that on the spectrum of in language learning, motivation is extremely important. And if you look at intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation, I think games fall kind of in that range. That there's some external rewards like getting a badge or getting points, but it also becomes a matter of internal motivation. You want to succeed, you want to get to the next level of the game, you want to get to the treasure or whatever it is that comes along with the game. So there are some positives there. And don't forget about being with friends and being happy. I think that's one of the most motivating things about games. And take a look at that Jane McGonigal video on TED-Ed. And you can see this presentation at a Google Drive with all the resources and references and things at the end of it. So, anyway, I'm going to stop there. I'm not terribly positive about games, except I like them. I think they're fun, and a lot of kids really do like them. So, thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Our next speaker is in from the West Coast. Katie Mitchell works with Rosetta Stone out there. And she's going to talk to us about lessons from building games.
So we built a game last year, and I'm going to talk about some of the things I learned during that process, and a lot of that is something that even if you don't use games in your classroom, there are things that you can use to gamify your class. So the number one thing I learned was about collaboration. I think this is becoming more and more relevant in our field as we're dealing with content experts on a variety of projects. But people come from such different perspectives, and learning how to work with them and each value the different perspectives. On the first day of our gaming project, we came to the consensus that language learning and good teaching were the most important, which I think if you went to another conference, about serious games and educational games, you'd see how that is sometimes difficult to agree on, surprisingly. But that meant that whenever there was a disagreement between how a game should be built from a designer's perspective or from the user interface perspective or from the visual perspective, we all had to say, good language teaching trumps everything. And to give you one example, in our game we have conversations that people do. And one of the things I wanted was to have some support for that, so you could pull up a dictionary, a bilingual dictionary, bilingual picture dictionary. But that meant that the visual team had to change where the characters were videoed. And the UI person had to design how that popped up. And the developer had to change the way the controls worked. And every single person had to agree that that was important. And it was my job to explain to them why that was needed and how that was actually more important than other things that would be put in the game. But game designers know a whole lot that I didn't know. So I'm going to walk you through some of the things I learned from them. So one is about failure states. They know how to make boom and splat and death fun. In our game, there's no boom, splat, or death, but they did definitely make not succeeding at something enjoyable or not amotivating. So people were still wanting to come back and do a conversation again or play a game again. And I think that's something we need to think about, how we can do that in our classes so that we're not giving an F, we're giving a boom or a splat. Also something about points. And when I went originally and was talking about how many points a game should be worth, you know, saying, oh, maybe this game is worth like 10 points. And that's exactly what we would do in our classes, right? We'd just say, that's a small thing, so it's 10 points. But they would say, what if we times that by 100? Wouldn't that be so much more exciting if that were worth 1,000 points? And it is. And imagine if I do that in my class, where instead of having a homework assignment that's worth 5 points, now it's worth 500 points. And you're not changing anything about your course. You're just timesing the points by 100. And game designers really know how to do things like this so that they're motivating and just these little tweaks. So they also know about exploration. And I think language educators know about that too. But we also want to make things sometimes so easy and give people all these access points to learning. And that's great. But game designers also know that it's a trick sometimes to make it a little bit challenging to find something, to get to that next thing. And that challenge and encouraging that exploration actually makes people want to continue to play and continue to learn. So that's something to think about. They also taught me about timing. Now, as a teacher, we all start out making lesson plans, and you have a 5-minute activity, and you have a pretty good idea about what a 5-minute activity looks like or a 10-minute activity. But game designers would talk about, well, what would that be like if you only gave them 3 minutes? And what would that game be like if you put a timer up during those 3 minutes? And each of those decisions actually changes how motivating and interesting and engaging the game is. And something that we can all learn a lot from. Definitely something I'm going to take back to the classroom. They also know a lot more about achievements and badges. And I think people sitting in this room have probably heard about how those can motivate and how we can use those. Same with progress. We tell people that they're, you know, right now you're getting an A in the class. But we also need to show them you're only halfway there. And what do you need to do to continue? And so some people talk about, when they talk about gamifying classes, having your points accumulate in the term so that you need so many experience points to get an A rather than, and that's part of being able to show progress. And game designers definitely know about that. But the biggest thing I want to take away from this as an educator is about replayability. Now, I think I build something, I build a great handout, and maybe someone will be able to use it next term. But what game designers do really well is they try and figure out how can we make this fun for a learner to do 10 times? How can we make it fun for them to come back over and over again? And when we think about this from our educators' perspective, and we think about how many times do people need to see a word to know it, maybe a dozen, this is really important and can be something very powerful that games can give and that we can learn from game designers. But we also know a lot of the same things, and we're coming at a lot of the same issues from different perspectives. So we both know that gameplay has to be well supported. And from an educator's perspective, that's about scaffolding learning. So one of our parts of the game happens in a restaurant. And you can talk with people and order food, but maybe some people aren't ready for that. So you can also go to the kitchen and look at all the food before you have a conversation. And so click on each of those little buttons and see the word and hear it. And that's going to help people prepare them, or they can go back to it, or they can pull it up in that bilingual dictionary. So from my perspective, I was already thinking about how we're combining the experience and supporting learners. But game designers are also thinking about it, how do they know how this page works? So that's so many buttons. How do we get them to the point where they know what to do here? And so we're all thinking about how to support gameplay, but from a very different perspective. And we're also all thinking about how to make it the right amount of difficult, have the right amount of difficulty. So something that's challenging, but it's not too difficult that people feel like they can't succeed. And it's not so easy that you aren't interested. And again, we're coming at it from different perspectives, but we're having the same goal. That really, I want you guys to take away that for me, the experience of building a game was really about coming together with this diverse team and learning how to speak about language education in a way that would help the game designers and the other people on the team know what the important decisions were and the things we couldn't compromise on. And at the same time, learn as much as I could from them, because they are, in their own way, great educators. So, thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Moving on to our third speaker, and I did forget to mention that we're moving along at a pretty rapid clip, so we're going to save a big chunk of time for questions at the end. So if your questions come up as we go along, just write them down. You'll have a chance. Our third speaker is Rodrigo Carvalho, who's from Georgia Tech. And Rodrigo has developed a course using League of Legends, and he's in an IEP. It's a special course that only uses League of Legends for its medium. Okay. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the League of Legends course that I designed. For those of you who are not too familiar with it, I put this busy picture over there on purpose. You know, it's kind of intimidating if you're not a gamer, if you're not familiar with the game. But, you know, its complexity does not mean that the game is, you know, useless. Or it's, in fact, the opposite. It shows that there's a pretty rich environment for language learning. So what is League of Legends then? It's, you know, like I said, the picture shows its complexity, so it's very hard for me to explain every single detail of the game in one shot, but I like this metaphor of comparing it to a hockey game or to a soccer game, where you have an arena and you have two teams trying to score. You know, it's basically the dynamics of the game. It's called a multiplayer online battle arena because of that. Most of the action takes place inside that context. It has RTS, which is real-time strategy, features to it, which basically is what I just showed. You're coordinating with your teammates in order to achieve a certain goal. But it also has RPG elements to it, and these RPG elements are, you know, a variety of multimedia, telling you descriptors about the characters, the story, the background story. So think of it a lot like you know, like a literary genre of its own, basically. So the game has four different arenas, but the most popular one is this one. It's a 5v5 combat, and the goal again is to destroy the enemy's base, which is called the Nexus inside the game. So you might be asking, like, why did I choose this game? As I played it, and I started playing it a long time ago, but I played it with my younger cousin. He's like, you know, he was 16 then, and I realized that as I played it, the game was just so rich with all sorts of input. So, for example, if you take the tutorial, this is a screenshot of the tutorial. You know, as you learn how to play, you're listening to instructions on how to achieve the basics, how to learn basic steps of playing a game, but you're also exposed to, you know, short paraphrased versions of that instruction in the top part of the screen, and on the side they have smaller, more detailed pieces of information that are just bombarded at you, and to which you have to respond quite quickly. So it really allows for you know, for a lot of impromptu response, and therefore, you know, a signal that perhaps comprehension was achieved. League of Legends, it's, you know, allows also, and it takes place most of the time with you know, in-team communication. So you use Skype to coordinate with your teammates when you're outside the classroom. That if you play with your teammates and then they're your classmates, you know, that's more room for talking outside the classroom. But you can also do that with native speakers. You can try to play on your own and you know, fill out the rest of the four people that are necessary to join the team with native speakers, which, you know, talk about the necessity of authentic experiences. This is a great environment for it. Also, because League of Legends is just extremely popular, I mean, chances are you might have one or two students that are already playing it. The Wall Street Journal reported 27 million players a day. That was 2012. It's probably way more right now. 32 million people saw the final, I mean, of the League of Legends championship. And yes, there is a world championship of League of Legends. And if it takes place in Malaysia or Korea, like the last one was, you can't get a visa to go there if you're a player, just like if you're an athlete. Yeah. So, so it's that popular. So it might seem that, you know, and maybe a lot of games are used in a context of trying to emulate some sort of reality, but these kinds of games are not only that, they are a reality. So they are a means to an end, and they are the end itself too. And it's fun and it's free. So then again, why not, you know, approach your students or, you know, get to know your students more and to see what's meaningful to them. So the motivation for creating this course was basically, you know, the need to find more learning environments outside the classroom. You know, a lot of the times our students were just, you know, getting together and they're going home and then they're just chatting with their, you know, people who share the same first language. They did not, they often complained that they did not participate in the target culture. So this gives them a lot of background and knowledge and things to share with native speakers, and with some level of confidence, in fact, because they would have things to share and conversation starters and things of that sort. We even had reports of people who finally managed to go out to nightclubs because they met native speakers online, and they seem to be very happy about that. And it's also a type of literacy. I mean, as games become more and more validated as a legitimate medium for learning and for studying, and just like a book is, you know, you're also teaching them that. So why not, right? Some of the theory behind it, you know, for my course, evidently there's a whole lot more than that. But I just really like this quote from Guy 2004. He was talking about learning as a cultural process, and games our reality as far as that's concerned. You know, people learn as cultural processes, whether it's this be cooking, hunting, or how to play video games, because you know, they're acting and talking to each other and engaging in authentic learning. They're not trying to emulate anything or memorize words outside the context of application. So that's real learning. Talk about, you know, the advantages of project-based and task-based learning. I think that speaks a lot to it. And Steinkuhler 2006 talked about, she did a study on massive multiplayer online games, and to basically figure out what was going on inside the, you know, the cognitive aspects of engaging in learning. And one of the things that she found is that there's individual and collaborative problem solving across multiple types of media. So then again, massive, you know, brain function here. Identity work, when you choose to play with a certain character, or as you relate to the other team members, what is your role? How do others see you? How do you see others? I mean, this is you know, a great environment for that kind of development. Joint negotiation of meaning and values also happens a lot in project-based learning and task-based learning, and also coordination of people. Like if you're a leader of a team, or if you're, you know, take a certain role inside the team, how do you manage the people to follow you, leadership, and all those things. The course that I created was part of the special purposes track. We have a level 100 to level 700 course at Georgia Tech, and after level 400, students can choose if they're going to a more academic-oriented or a more ESP-based track. So this was created in the context of that ESP track. Okay. So the classes were Monday to Friday, about 50 minutes. You know, a regular League of Legends match would normally last about 40 minutes or 45 minutes, so it was kind of perfect for that scenario. It was composed of high intermediate to advanced learners most of the time. I would not make a League of Legends only base course for really basic beginner learners, because some of the content might be a little too much. However, I think parts of the game can be used with lower level learners. I think it's still possible. You know, it's just a matter of scaffolding. The materials I used was the League of Legends software and the community and support websites. So I divided the games into four big learning environments. The tutorials was, like I showed in the beginning, sequencing of you know, great input and audio and textual input. There's a strategy part to it, which is actual gameplay. That's where people coordinate and share techniques and evaluate performance and make comments on other people's performance. There's a community part of it, which was sometimes referred to as the big G part of the game, which is when they go to forums and you know, share experiences and things like that. There's a lot of mini negotiation going on there, native speaker, non-native speaker interaction, all those things. And the lore itself, I think, is a very valuable part of the game. The lore is, as I see it, is its own genre of writing. So I do think it's really important to expose students to lore. If you have read gaming lore, you probably know it's a somehow chaotic sequencing of events that's even hard to keep track, and it's great for advanced learners and can learn a lot of vocabulary with that. Just quickly, the course objectives, these are some of the course objectives. I offered it we offered it last year, and now we're offering it again. We're actually in the middle of the session. So here, like you can see, they can summarize and remember vocabulary, discuss, apply the vocabulary they learn in the tutorials and in the lore inside the game as they act. So again, contextualizing learning, and they can also, you know, compose descriptive essays about their favorite game, their favorite match, their favorite character. Critical analysis, and great environment here for critical thinking. So there's plenty to it. And task-based and project-based learning, like creating a video for new League of Legends players, who actually did that and was It was great. It was quite successful, I think. It took about a week to do it, but as we have an 8-week course, and it was really suitable for it. Some of the course assignments directly, you know, was create a voice there, the activity, did a summary of a city-state where they had to read the lore, learn the characteristics of the place where their favorite champion came from, and then, you know, create a summary of that. I had a requirement on community postings too, so they had to check and see what people were talking about the game, and then participate in it and interact with, you know, native speakers. Again, another opportunity for learning. I mean, none of it is really, this kind of learning almost does not need to be super scaffolded because, you know, it's really coming in contact with real language, you know. This is an exact passage that I got from a student essay. It's just the first paragraph of his descriptive essay. I mean, it talks about how traumatizing his first battle was after he lost. But it was great. I was able to work on descriptive features, descriptive phrases, a lot of stuff. And they had never seen that kind of rhetorical structure before. So for them, it was like a great, highly contextualized environment for learning those kinds of descriptors, for example. After the game was done, you have, after you play the game, you're led to a screen where you can analyze data. The data is about like how many times you got killed, how many times you killed your classmates, or how much gold you got. And yeah, when they kill their classmates is really when the class starts. And then in the end, you have those graphs which are really useful. If you look at the two lines that are going up and down, the blue one is the team that lost, so they got less gold, and then the purple one is the one that the team that won, so they got more gold. But there's like in the bottom, in the x-axis, you see the amount, the minutes. You know, so at one point in that match, there was a breakthrough in the difference of gold. And they can analyze that and think, okay, when did that happen? Why did that happen? And then they look up in those little symbols up at the top, and then they see that, you know, that was when we lost that tower, or that was when we engaged in a massive team fight and we lost. So we can't do that anymore. We have to avoid that. So I give them like a small handout with you know, individual objectives for them to accomplish, and then after that, they see the results, they start reflecting on it, like when did we fail, where did we fail, how can we do better, and so on and so forth. And then if they have pretty good predictions or they just kind of participate in it, I see a difference in analysis or substance in their analysis, then they get credit for it. Of course, there's always challenges to it. Technology glitches, I don't think you can ever get away from them. People trying to connect to the server and the server is down, for example, so I always have to try to check the server first before a battle. Student identity and beliefs about language learning, a lot of people and a lot of teachers still believe that we can't learn things with games. So sometimes students come in and they're like, okay, I'm going to take this class because it's the easiest class in the world. And they get awfully disappointed. And first time we offered it, I think there was a 30% failing rate, and it was exactly because of that. And they took too long to realize that they actually had to do work. you know, matching the number of students can sometimes be a challenge. The game happens in 5 versus 5 or 3 versus 3. You can't create custom games when you have the exact number of people, but let's say if you have 17 people in your class or somebody misses classes, I always bring my laptop and then I'm like, okay, if your team is missing somebody, I'm going to join you. And it's actually good because I get to monitor them. And I also tend to participate in the Skype activities that they do at home as a moderator to see if they're actually, you know, not just going crazy on things. And I actually found this app recently that actually tells me when they are online, and I can text them, and it appears right over, like right in front of them in the screen when they are playing the game. So it works beautifully in that regard. Anyway, that's about it. These are the references, my contact information. Thanks.
Thanks, Rodrigo. I'm going to take your class as soon as I retire.
Our fourth speaker is Jeff Kuhn. Jeff's from Ohio, and he's going to tell us, with Rodrigo, we saw an application, and Jeff's going to tell us another application concerning journals.
Hello, everyone. All right. Minecraft plus zombies equals awesome. Thank you for your time. That is all I have to say. So I'm talking about journaling the zombie apocalypse with my students, and you can tweet along at JeffKuhn72 if you'd like. But what it comes down to is when we look at games, and I have small g games up there for a reason, is that games are an intentionally designed artifact. Just like a good classroom, good lesson plan, it's intentionally designed. Every aspect of that game is designed to encourage and motivate and entice the player. And I want to tap into that as a teacher, because also games take someone who has no ability in the game and turns them to an expert in a relatively short amount of time, which is difficult to do in the classroom. So how can we do that as well? And ramp up the complexity in the process. So I've been looking at these sort of aspects of games and saying, well, how can I do this in the classroom? How can I use game mechanics and game design in my own classroom? Because also, fun is a universal human activity, right? Far too long we associated learning with not being fun, and we have to kind of ditch that. And the call ask is a great place to start. So my classroom, what I really struggled with in my class was that every time my students did an activity, every time we did a reading, every time we did a grammar exercise, the context changed. So that meant new schema, new background, new information. So my students are always kind of just trying to stay up with different contexts and different schema. So I asked myself, what if we had one context through the whole semester and they could use the same schema, activate the same background knowledge over and over and again? Would I see better writing? So the reason I think about this is because in a classroom also the second challenge is we often have 10, maybe 15 minutes to do an activity, and for a game, that's not nearly enough time. So what if I did the long haul? The game was just part and parcel of my class for an entire semester. Because usually about 10 minutes of class time, inside of a game, that's just when the player is developing agency, when they learn every single control they can use and everything that they can manipulate. And then it's time to move on to a different classroom activity. The student really didn't do much, and a lot of times it can look like goofing off because they're gaining agency. The sweet spot with games is after about 4 hours, a player will start to internalize their goal. So they're not trying to win the game. They're saying, I'm going to get Mario through the game on one life. Right? They make up their own goal, and they say, this is going to be the goal that I play inside the game. And then also about 40 hours into a game, a player will start to geek out, right, or develop tremendous expertise in this game. So she's played for a long time, and she suddenly becomes an expert and moves out into the big G games, the community. So 400 plus, that's a whole other story. So as I mentioned, games, small g games, this is something that Jim G talks about. That's the software. So for instance, like World of Warcraft, if we bring the game into the classroom, like League of Legends or World of Warcraft, that's just the software, that's small g. But we also need to think about the big G game. So when we say big G, we're talking about the community that exists around that game. And if you're interested in this, take a look at Steve Thorne's work. He's done a lot of good stuff with the big G games. Because when we use the small G game, we get the player, we get the software, we get the rules. Right? But the big G games are players, forums, YouTube postings, threads, different sorts of activities. And so I wanted my students in my class to tap into a larger world. So how could I do that? Well, what I tried to do there is figure out a designed experience. Once again, games are an intentionally designed artifact. I wanted my students to have designed experiences where, as Kurt Squire says, they learn through a grammar of doing and being. And finally, Cole, back in 1984, he said, well, direct experience comes through action taking and seeing the consequences of that action. My class, my students always got to observe action. They read someone doing something else, right? They wrote about someone else. But when's it their turn to take action and be an active participant? So how can my students get agency in the classroom as well was really important. Right? So, and this goes back to something that Gagne in instructional design has talked about for decades, right? You know, a key element of problem solving is that the learner not only devise the plan, but act upon it. So I wanted my students to be able to act upon plans that they developed for true learning. And, you know, game designers know this too, that it's not just doing that action, but also having a challenge with meaning, right? So if we bring a game into the classroom, well, why are we playing it? What's the meaning behind it is really important, because if they don't see that and they don't see the proper steps, they quit. So, for me, this is what I wanted. I was thinking about my class, and I saw this picture, and I said, this will be my classroom. Because what's really important when we use games, you know, games provide an essential experience, right? When we think about an activity in the language classroom, we might say to ourselves, I want my student's goal to be to learn the perfect tense. That's not an experience, right? I want my students to feel the pressure of using a second language on a first date. That's an experience, right? The language will come through on that. So I wanted my class to be this, right? So why zombies? Well, I really wanted to encourage critical thinking, right? Very quickly we established the class is not about zombies. The class is, America has this weird obsession with the end of the world, and we have this incredible pessimism and a lot of fear-mongering. Zombies are great for fear-mongering, and then also we associate with like technology, right? We just all walk around mindless staring at our phones, right? So things like this we got to discuss in the class. Also, zombies are great for genre, right? Any kind of movie genre, there are zombies. There's a romantic comedy about a zombie. I won't go into it. But so we can look at these different things. Where do zombies pop up, and why are they such a ubiquitous villain? Right? And it was great, like we did a quick activity very early on where I had all the students draw a ghost. And the ghosts were all very culturally specific, because ghosts have been around in folklore for thousands of years. Zombies are a relatively new phenomenon, and they all come basically from the George Romero movie. So when they draw a zombie, we all have the same mental image, because they're a new phenomenon, and they're just sort of a great generic villain. Also, I wanted my students to get the idea that academics are a frame of mind, right? Whether they disagreed with zombies because of personal beliefs, religious beliefs, cultural beliefs, that wasn't really sort of an obstacle in the class, because I'm like, we're not looking at these things. I don't care if you like them or not. Let's look at them as an object that occurs in American society where you happen to be studying. So let's examine America through these things. And also, I got tired of papers on smoking and divorce and television and violence. And I said, those are done, right? You're all going to write about zombies, and here's how. Because if you approach something academically, it will be good, right? So let's be objective about things and just step back and examine. So how did I do this? Well, we started out with the Center for Disease Control Zombie Preparedness webpage. So I asked my students, I'm like, why? Why does this happen? So what is the author's purpose? And they kind of stumbled through it, and they're like, does America have zombies? And I'm like, no, we don't have zombies. Okay. But if I'm prepared for the zombie apocalypse, I'm prepared for a tornado, a hurricane, and what have you. So it wasn't just this, though. I really wanted my students to experience the zombie apocalypse. So that was the next step. So to do that, I used Minecraft, and I used the book World War Z. Now, if you're familiar with the movie World War Z, I'm sorry, but the book is incredible. Max Brooks uses Studs Terkel's World War II life narratives approach. So it's how, 10 years on, how did people survive the zombie apocalypse? So they're relating their life stories. So I wanted my students to read the book and then experience those same phenomenon inside of a game where they could take action. So we did that in this city. This was our big city. Very early on, students could kind of go about their normal life, and then the apocalypse occurred. Right? So inside the city, then also I had them write. And one of the things I did very early on is I ditched drafts. Like, I don't understand why as a teacher I only see first draft, second draft, final draft. I need to know how the sausage gets made, right? So I moved all the writing over to Google Docs. So as students wrote, I could see if they wrote something, and then if we discussed it in class, did they go back and make changes? So I had timestamps every 11 seconds. You know, I mentioned in class that one particular student wrote on Valentine's Day at 9 p.m., and they all went, how do you know that? It's like, I am the internet. And you know. But I wanted to see how they really wrote and how things went. So what happened? We had three papers, researching phenomenon, arguing a position, proposing a solution, and we rotated through these. Now, real quick, Basically, what they had to do in the researching phenomenon was develop a theory. So the apocalypse happens, they needed to find out why it happened. So they had to go out into the big G community and figure out what could possibly cause a zombie apocalypse. After that, what they actually found was that in World War Z, there was a particular chapter where a lot of mistrust set in with a group of survivors. Sure enough, inside of Minecraft, they all stopped trusting each other and all started hoarding supplies. So they could draw these parallels between the experiences in the book and the experience in the game. The second paper we did was arguing a position, and I said, look, you guys are losing the zombie war. I'm going to implement the Redeker plan. And inside the book, what that means is you sacrifice a certain amount of your population to the zombies, and you keep your essential survivors. My students all agreed except for one. David wrote his paper. He said, here's who's living in the class, and here's who's dying. He put his students' names out there, his classmates, and threw them to the dogs, or the zombies in this case. So we got to argue, do the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few? What does it take to truly survive? It was great because one student wrote, we saved Jeff first, and then another student posted, yeah, but what can he do? They didn't save me. But what was interesting, especially in this second paper, is students really started kind of citing and referencing the book and their experiences in Minecraft. So Steven here, for instance, he actually said, no, we don't need to implement this plan. There are plenty of supplies. And he shows inside of his writing where these supplies are, and then, you know, kind of cites it. He's trying to be, you know, APA about it. And it was kind of a really great experience. Finally, the third paper is we moved outside of Minecraft, and I said, look, you guys are zombie experts now. The city of Athens needs your help. We need a zombie preparedness plan for the city of Athens. So one paper earlier, everyone was against the Redeker plan. The third paper, they said, here's who's living and here's who's dying in Athens, Ohio. So we extended from the game into the real world, and so they had to actually figure out, like, they found some houses in South Green dormitories in Athens, and they said, here's how many beds we have, here's how many survivors we can take. So they started examining how far is it to grocery stores, the police station, the hospital. So they had to go out in the community, find these places, and figure out if it's likely they could get there in time. So my students really liked the social aspect of the game and the possibility space, that they could do things and try things, and they had a lot of freedom there. They also like the ownership. In some research, Zhang 2009 found that when students use virtual environments, there's less incidence of plagiarism because they're writing about their own experience, which is really effective. And finally, the students metagamed very quickly, where they tried to outthink me as the game designer. So they were trying to figure out how to best manipulate Jeff to manipulate the game to get the grades they wanted, which was fun. So references and thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. So Jeff, if you got sacrificed to the zombies, but you're standing here now, what does that mean? So we come now to our last speaker, which is Rick Rosenberg. He's from the Department of State, and he's going to talk to us about another game, Trace Effects.
Thank you for the invitation, and I hope everyone is enjoying this as much as I am. I am not a violent game player, but I think I'm going to start now because I am totally motivated to see how to adapt this for the classroom. Do we have my slides? Okay. Oh, what? Oh, wait. All right, so today we're going to take a look at trace effects. We've already heard something about what the game is and the basic functionality of it. I'll touch on that, but really I want to talk about the game and its extension materials, trace in the classroom but outside of computers, non-electronic trace, and as we just heard from the project with the zombies, how to bring trace out of the classroom into the community, into society, and bring them around the world with social and educational projects. So in brief, just to restate, the State Department developed an online and DVD video game to help students learn culture and language through interactive 3D immersive gaming. And the desire for this is obvious from the other presenters, students are motivated through games. How do you reach students? You play games. You find out what they're using. They're holding their cell phones. They're going everywhere. They're in front of screens. They're motivated to do that. Let's tie into that motivation. So we've got 7 illustrated chapters, online and mobile language games built in, a very detailed teacher's manual, certificate of completions in each chapter, and key links to content, free content. Trace lives at the AmericanEnglish.state.gov website with all these other resources. Trace is both an online game and a game that can be run off of a DVD. These DVDs have been distributed around the world, literally to every consulate and embassy around the world. So if you're outside of the United States and you want a copy of the DVD, you can contact the Public Affairs Office closest to you. Now, once you play a chapter in Trace Effects, you earn 2 things. Of course, the admiration of your peers, but that's in addition to getting one of these chapters. Now, these chapters encapsulate the themes of the chapter and the adventures. Of course, you would not give this to students before they play, because that would eliminate all the fun adventure of actually doing the games, guessing, getting answers wrong, and having those challenges. They also get a certificate of completion. Now, if you work like we do in the Department of State around the world, there's a phenomenon called certificates. Students and educators love certificates. We have one built in. Educators can use this as they wish. Notice it's not signed. It's up to the teachers to use it or not. We have 4 multiplayer games. Now, again, Trace is an interactive, immersive game. As part of the package, we added these competitive games as well, language games that also give you points. Because the motivation also, in addition to the certificate, of course, is to compete for points. The world leader of Trace is a Bolivian teacher, young Bolivian teacher, with twice as many points as everyone else. It's someone that Jeff has had contact with and worked with in the past as well. So that might be an unfair advantage. We also have, this is very unusual for a video game, we have a video walkthrough. So if you're an educator with limited internet access, you can use the video and pull that out and use just little clips of video as you would anything else to support lesson plans and your objectives. We have the other kinds of extension materials. We have a teacher's manual, student worksheets, English teaching forum articles built in, Trace class extension activities, all kinds of games, and we have a community of practice. I'll give you a little bit more about this and about how the materials we've developed through the community of practice worldwide by participants. This is an example of one of the games that comes with. It's a starter template that we put out there, and teachers around the world have developed dozens of their own games and have shared them on our Ning. The teacher's manual is very unusual for a game, even an educational game, in that it covers all kinds of practical aspects of classroom management, highlights language skills, task charts, and it's completely built upon the structure of the TESOL technology standards. 4 of the developers that worked on Trace Effects actually wrote TESOL technology standards, so we have kind of inside track. Trace is being developed about the same time that the technology standards are being published. But again, about extending Trace Effects, what may not be obvious right now is that we really didn't develop Trace for the kids per se. We put it out there that they could learn the game with a lowercase g that Jeff just talked about, but we were really interested in a larger case g. In other words, in how we can go from here on the outside. So how can Trace be used to support existing objectives in the classroom is our primary objective with this. Now, kids, we want to play Trace, it's engaging, it's fun, but really it's been designed kind of in the background for educators. How can you take this resource and support what's already going on in the classroom? So we've seen games flipped around the other side so far in these presentations are, here are 2 games that are developed for playing, and this is a game that's developed for learning that you can turn around and use to support other objectives and do other games and sorts of things. So many of the content that's been developed, again, that we have on our Ning, are web quests, treasure hunts, role plays, scenarios, reader's theater, tours and Trace, key pal exchanges and journals, extended adapted games, and Trace and context writing activities. For example, Trace came from the future to the present through a time machine. It was a terrible accident, and he had to get back to his life in the future. Now, and everyone he meets collaborates with him, cooperates with him through communication, and that's the motivation. That's how you win Trace Effects, is by collaborating, cooperating, and communicating. Now, what we've done is told students around the world, you know, Trace is there for you to have adventures with. Trace loves to travel. Trace is there to help. So we've had students in Uzbekistan write their own chapters of Trace. What adventures does Trace have in Uzbekistan? Well, how can he help? And he worked on some ecological programs. He had adventures. And at some point, we're gathering these, and we'll put those into comics, and eventually, we hope, Trace, too, have adventures from the world by students around the world. People have even written songs about TraceFX. I wonder who wrote that. And we have an app that works on feature phones. I know that everyone's all excited about smartphones these days, but we've had, as you'll notice, we have a lot of content on our app, but particular to Trace, we have two Trace interactive games. One is Trace Word Soup, and the other one is not listed there. But just to give you an idea, on feature phones that have a screen like this old BlackBerry I'm holding up, even smaller than the screen, we've had over 4 million plays of this TraceFX game. Just plays, just people where they don't have access to the internet, they have a feature phone, they can still access all of this content through the app. So please let your colleagues know if they'd like to get a lot of content. The price is right. It's free for everyone. We have our community of practice, again, to join ideas with educators and learners around the world. Anyone can join. It may take a few days, as we have concerns about making sure we get real educators in there. So it's shapingenglish.ning.com. And what you see on the right is one page of four of webinars that we've held, again, from educators around the world who've used Trace, adapted Trace, how to use Trace in relation to graphic novels, many different subjects around the teaching and learning with Trace. And those are all there 24/7. What I'd like to end with now is an example of, and I'm hopeful this link will work, an example of what some students did around the world as they learned about Trace and became friends with Trace. They took Trace in different formats, and they showed what he was doing in their communities. Where did he visit? What did he see? What projects did he help with? And we put them together. We had a competition. Over 400 students participated. We're seeing kids that have played Trace all around the world. Pakistan was a very special place that had helped with the pilot of Trace. Like Jordan, Sao Paulo, of course. Again, these were all sent in by kids themselves. And in many of these places, the kids are writing their own stories, their own adventures with Trace. Okay, so that's a little bit of Trace around the world. Again, it's with this, I will wrap this up. But again, I'd invite you to join the Ning. Trace is online. Communities are out there of sharing ideas and extended activities with Trace.
We've got the beam behind us right there. And today what we're going to talk about is the top 10 cities that you should visit when you come to the U.S. Now, the thing is, I'm not going to be talking about Orlando like Disney World.
Yeah. Kind of stuff, because very last speaker.
Here we go.
Yep, that's great. Right. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. So we have about 10 minutes for questions. So I'm going to ask the panelists to come up, if you will, and then I'm going to take questions or comments from the floor and let you direct them at whoever you want. So can you guys come back up here? And Vance, if we have questions that come in from the webcast, that's good too. Yeah, just come right on up here. We'll have to keep everything on the microphone so people on the webcast can hear it. Okay, and I'm going to have to repeat your questions, unless you want to use the microphone, which you're welcome to do. Yes. So the question is, what's the name of Kate's game, and is it available?
It's called Discover Languages, and it is available, but I don't want to hawk anything, so you can talk to him.
Okay. She said to talk to her afterwards. Yeah. Okay. Another question, anyone? Yes. So the question was about the cost of League of Legends, I got that right. And some of the, if there was any problem with putting it on student computers or how you played it.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's free. League of Legends is free. All you pay for is if you want to like get skins for your champions and all that, but it's free, easy to download. And what I do is when I set up the syllabus, I put the processing requirements a computer must have. So whenever people sign up, they kind of got to know that they need Skype and they need enough RAM to run Skype and League of Legends at the same time. But yeah, and I try to advise them to, you know, first day of class to download and let it update and just try to be, you know, careful with that. But that's no major issue or anything like that.
You can repeat the question.
So the question was a little more about the journaling aspect of my class. So outside of the three main papers, because it was a full semester, so I wanted them to do a little more work, and so every 3 days or so they had to journal. So a few journals a week that kind of narrated their character's experience throughout the game. So they all had kind of one giant Google Doc that they could put all their ideas into. So they had their journals, and then they could have a place for their paper as they developed it. And so it was an idea of just putting, let's put all our writing in one spot so you can start to draw ideas from everything that you've written. So they would often have to, what was their character doing when the apocalypse started, what happened when they encountered their first zombie, and then just day-to-day of who they're trusting and who they're starting to work with. So the Google Doc was full of just all their writing that we could kind of keep tabs on. And then, yeah, the three formal papers after that.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is there room for Trace Effects with adult learners or is it just for children? It was designed for the sweet spot of adolescent learners, but quite frankly, I've had learners as young as 5 and as old as 85 use Trace. And again, it's about how the teachers using Trace can adapt that to the learners. Now, manage the expectations, but the themes in Trace, which I didn't have time to include things like entrepreneurship, science and technology, empowering women, conflict resolution. So these themes could be used with adult learners. You would just have to really adapt the game to what their learning objectives are.
Repeat the question.
So the question was, how did we help students interact with the Big G game community that our games have? Because both of these games have huge communities. And what was really nice is, with Minecraft, and maybe Rodrigo can speak this with League of Legends, is I had a student who actually played it. And as soon as I found that out, I backed way off. And I let that student become the content expert. And so people had Minecraft questions, I directed them to him first. And then he and I could kind of figure things out if he didn't know. And so other things is, because zombies are so just generic, you know, like The Walking Dead is on and some things like that. So they could start to identify those. And then they would start bringing it into the classroom, like, oh, have you seen this? And there was a South Park episode that featured Minecraft, and they saw the commercial. So like three students come in like, this Wednesday, we've got to watch, you know, as a class. And so they start to kind of find that. And so I would push them towards certain things. Go check out this wiki. Go check out that. But other than that, I really wanted them to kind of find that through self-discovery.
Yeah, I think my answer is pretty similar to Jeff's. I'd normally like them, I mean, I'd just guide them to the proper website. I show what the regular comment looks like and, you know, guide them around. But, yeah, I think the whole idea of it is for them to feel comfortable enough with the game. And I think they start doing that more heavily after. Like, in my course, it's probably after week 5 or week 4 when they have played it enough and they have an identity inside the game that they want to share and they want to compare with other people. And then that kind of happens very naturally. I mean, almost to a point that they participate way more, and some of them know way more than I do.
Any other questions? Panelists, did you have any questions for each other or thoughts?
What's next? Maybe my question for the whole group is, you know, as TESOL starts to tackle the idea of games and having them as part of the classroom, where as a field do we go next? You know,
building our own games.
Yeah, you know. That's what I was
going to
say.
Do
you want to answer your question?
No, I'm looking for ideas.
I addressed a little bit. Thanks for the question. I addressed a little bit of this in my comments. I do see this as empowering the students to take a more larger participatory role in the design of games and the content of games. Let them find out what's interesting, exciting, engaging, and do the kind of amazing adaptations all of you have done to adapt this to the classroom. Set up models so that they can actually do the work themselves in the context of the learning objectives.
I think also it's not just using games that are real games, but in gamifying your classes to some degree. I think that can be very, very successful, as I think we found last fall, that getting these extrinsic rewards like grades may not be as motivating as setting goals for students, which then becomes intrinsic motivation in what they're doing. And it's the task for the teacher then is to find, how do I make learning intrinsically satisfying, which is what we've been trying to do all along. But I think the gamifying is good, allowing students more time than you thought they might need or less time than you thought they might need. But then having some leeway where you can, you know, you have another life and you can go back and redo that part of the course and get a better score on it.
Yeah, I think, just to reiterate what's been said, I think that the power is to build our own games and make sure they're exactly what we want, but also to make sure that as we build them, we're building and sharing the community around the games and the other activities, or tapping into the networks that are already out there of people playing Minecraft and League of Legends. Because we're all talking about free games, and there are so many out there, and how do we really bring that into the classroom and make sure that what we're doing in the class is as powerful as it can be.
So panel, thank you very much for a really interesting late in the conference panel. Thank you.
Probably my director looking for me.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess.